Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. In the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Okay, today we're going to begin taking a look at St. John of the Cross. St. John of the Cross is one of the two doctors of the church in mystical theology. The other one is Teresa of Avila. They were contemporaries. They were both Carmelites. Teresa was tasked by God to reform the Carmelite nuns, and John of the Cross was tasked by Christ to reform the Carmelite friars. They were having these big battles within the order, and they had the calced and the discalced Carmelites, and basically they meant whether you wore shoes or not. But they had these philosophical battles, and they would actually throw each other in jail and stuff like that. And they had John of the Cross in jail for quite a while, and in Toledo, Spain. And this is also during the Spanish Inquisition. All this was going on, and so a lot of their writings, and like Teresa's writings, she'd be very careful about what she said, otherwise the Inquisition would have gotten all over her. And you don't see it so much in John, but in Teresa, she says things like, "I knew a person who had this happen to him," you know, well, she was talking about herself. But if she had said that, "This happened to me," the Inquisition would have said, "Oh, you're bragging," you know, and they would have done all kind of bad things to her. So she had to be very, very careful politically about what she was saying. John, it wasn't so bad. They would have gotten all over her because they had this really degraded view of women back in that time, especially during the Inquisition. Like, they were all stupid, belonged in a house having babies and cleaning and cooking, and they weren't supposed to think, you know. And if anybody could think, it was Teresa, you know. So she was dealing with all those political issues as well as trying to explain to her nuns what the growth in spirituality was like. And so John is doing the same thing here. When Teresa met John, she just latched on to him as her spiritual director because he understood exactly what she was talking about, because they were both going through the same kind of experience. And John had been very, very impressed with Solomon's Song of Songs. That's why I suggested you might want to read that first before we get in here. John had it memorized, as a matter of fact. And so you see a lot of references to the Song of Songs in his writings, because he saw Solomon having gone through the same experiences that he was going through in his spiritual growth. And so he saw himself starting off with the purgative way, and then the illuminative way, and then the unitive way. And that only really happens with Christ. And so Solomon was, you know, beginning to get there, but he was never able to go all the way. He got as far as betrothal, but never got to the spiritual marriage stage. And that's what John, you know, was able to get to, and that's what Teresa was able to get to. But they express it very differently. John talks about different experiences with Christ. He talks about Christ as the bridegroom, himself as the bride, because that's how Christ talked about it in the Gospels. You know, while you have the bridegroom here with you, rejoice. And when he's gone, then you can fast and do penance and stuff like that. And so, and Jesus talked about the going to heaven as the marriage feast of heaven. So he's always using marital imagery in his discussions about the relationship between man and God. And so you see a lot of that in John's writings. He references the Song of Songs a lot, but you see that kind of imagery in John of the Cross. And none of the verses in the spiritual canticle actually mention Christ. He never uses his word, the term Christ. He never refers to it as Christ. But he refers to him as the bridegroom. That's how he refers to him, the whole thing. So, and he's always talking about the loving exchange between the soul and Christ, and the Christ is the bridegroom. So all through these stanzas, when it talks about the bridegroom talking or the bride talking, the bride is John and the bridegroom is Christ. So you get those right. At the very end of the canticle, he's got a reference to Aminadab. And you wonder, well, he's never talked about him all through here. Where'd that come from? And that's his term for Satan. So when you see that show up at the end, in the last verse or two, he's talking about that. And what he's saying there is that once you get to that point in your development, Satan can't do anything to you. And so the first part of it is you're doing the work, the purgative way. And that's the same thing Teresa talked about in her spiritual canticle. They just use different imagery. In hers, she says people are walking around on this big plane, walking among all the snakes and bugs and reptiles and stuff. And then the soul notices this big castle, this big brilliant, like a diamond, but it's dirty and all. And so the person gets curious and wants to walk in. Well, she's saying that's God calling them. In John, he says that the bridegroom is like a hunter, and he shoots an arrow and wounds the person with a wound of love. Okay, it's like Cupid, the same kind of imagery. But he talks about being wounded with the wound of love, and when God wounds you with that wound of love, it makes you seek him. It makes you want to find him. And he uses the imagery of the stag and the hunter and the stag, where the bridegroom is the stag and the bride is the hunter looking for the stag. And so you see a lot of that kind of imagery. Teresa talks about going through different rooms. And when she says when you get to the fourth mansion, that's when you're at the point where you kind of relax and let God start doing all the work. And at that point, Satan really can't do much with you anymore. But up until then, you got to do a lot of work to get him, out of your system. And with John, he's talking about these different stages. And so he says, and what he's talking about is mystical theology. And so the point he's making here about mystical theology is that a person can go through all of this and understand what's happening, even though they can't explain it well. Because when God begins to work in you the way he's talking about, it's hard to put into words and explain precisely what's really going on. Because you're talking about a mystical relationship that is beyond normal experience. And that's why you can't just write it down like an essay. And so he found poetry as one of the best ways to try to express that, what he was going through. And I hate poetry. I can't stand to read poetry. But I didn't mind reading this because it doesn't rhyme or anything. It's just just the imagery. So I could tolerate this better than I could most English poetry. I had 2 years of English literature in college, and it was all poetry. And it drove me absolutely berserk. I couldn't stand it. But anyway, he's not doing too bad. As you get down about to the middle, he talks about how the beloved, how the bridegroom set the soul ablaze by a loving touch. And so all these touches that God gives you are ways of communicating himself to the soul. Teresa says that God can communicate more about himself to a person in 1 second than they could get from years of study. Because he's God. He can teach you himself in an instant. So that's what he's doing with John. He's given him these insights into himself, and therefore really giving John more to love. Because the more John understands God, the better he can love him, the more completely he can love him. And that's what God wants. He wants you to love him so completely that you have no other love in your life. accept God. And I mean, you don't love things. You just love God. And then you love other people because God loves them. And so the more you can love God, the more completely you can actually love your spouse and other people. So that's the point he's kind of making through here.
But if God, why doesn't God give more people these touches that would be a better world?
Because they're not disposed for them. You got to dispose yourself
to
it.
You have to seek him.
Yeah, but you got to be willing to put aside the things of the world. Remember the story about in the Gospels about the rich young man?
Right.
That's that kind of thing. A lot of people are very attached to the things of this world. And they aren't willing to give up. You have to look at what you have in a material sense and say, if necessary, I could turn my back on this if it means I know I'm getting closer to God and going to heaven. A lot of people can't do that because they're so attached to the things of this world that they can't do that.
I could never let go of my house.
You'd have to.
Your house? Yeah, would you?
Whatever it takes, you know. When Mary Beth and I bought our house, you know, we got this 58-acre plot of land on a deal that was unbelievable. And we built our house, and the day I went to closing, the first thing that crossed my mind is, I got to be willing to give this up. As much as I love this land and, you know, and living here, I got to be willing to give this up if necessary. You know, if I got to make that choice, that's what I got to do. And there aren't too many people, I think, that's the first thought that comes to their mind when they're going to close it on their house, you know.
Well, you have to have a place to live.
Yeah, and you trust God to take care of you, you know. You say, okay, you asked me to give up this, where do you want me to live? And you put your trust in it. Yeah. And so that's the kind of thing that John is talking about a lot through here. And of course, being a monk, it was easier for him because he didn't own anything. You know, it's harder for lay people who have, you know, property and stuff they got to take care of, a job they got to go do, and you know, animals they got to take care of and all like that. So it's a little little hard. Expression of the ineffable. He says, John says the people cannot declare fully the understanding or the experience that they have when God begins to work in them this way. And that's kind of the same thing Teresa felt too. She felt that poetry was probably a good way to express that too. She didn't write a lot of poetry, but she said that even if you are not a good poet, sometimes that's the best way you can kind of express to yourself what's going on inside yourself. Because it doesn't lend itself to strict logical deductive kind of reasoning, you know. And John uses an expression in a lot of his writings that's the I don't know what. And he said there's an I don't know what that strives to be articulated, and that I don't know what phrase is what he uses in place of being able to actually explain what's going on. When he has this mystical experience and he's trying to tell you about it and trying to tell you about the effects of it, he uses that expression a lot, hey, I don't know what, because he finds it hard to put in words what's going on. Teresa had a different way of explaining it. She, instead of trying to explain to you what's going on, she tells you what the result of that might be. But she also says you don't have to have any of these experiences to keep progressing spiritually. So these are things that can happen to people, but you don't have to have them in order to be able to advance spiritually. So they're not a necessity. But she was talking about things like, you know, the ascetical experiences that she would have. She would sometimes feel God coming on her and just taking charge of her soul. And she would start just praying. One time she was in chapel and she just elevated 4 feet off the floor. She was just hanging there in midair. And she didn't know it, but her nuns saw it when they came by, you know. And they call it the transverberation of St. Teresa, I think they call that. But she would have these various experiences. And so she would tell her young nuns that as you progress, you might experience this stuff. But you don't have to experience it. It's not necessary to advance spiritually. So you can go all the way to spiritual marriage without ever having those kinds of experiences. But some people, God finds it's helpful to give them those experiences. And then it mentioned that the Song of Songs is the principal source for the spiritual canticle. That was a work that John, it says John found an expression of his own profound experience. And he found that in the scenes, images, and words of the Song of Songs, even though sometimes foreign to his environment with which to create his own work. Excuse me. He also says that when God gives you these touches where he explains himself, teaches you about himself, you get this interior union with God. He says that endures for some days after the spark of the divine touch has actually passed. So it has a lasting effect that can endure for a longer period of time than just that momentary touch. It says, this love, says John, lasts together with its effect a long while, and sometimes a day or two or many days, though not always in the same degree of intensity or in the same manner. And so as God gives you these various touches, he's actually teaching you about himself. And the more you know about him, the more about him there is for you to love. And so that's what he's doing. Each of those touches is a way of helping you love him more. And that's really what the end objective is. That's what he wants you to do. So this whole spiritual canticle is a story about love. A love in response to Christ's love for him. And he said it's essentially a dynamic thing. The love moves forward. And what he means by that is that this poem, this spiritual canticle, starts off with the purgative way, where you're withdrawing from things of the world, going into the illuminative way, where you begin to get the insights, and finally in the unitive way, where your soul is united to that of Christ, where you have that union, the spiritual union, the spiritual marriage, where he gives himself to you and you give yourself to him. And you're still an individual, but you have that union. And he calls it spiritual marriage. So the bride goes out searching for her beloved to all the different ways. He uses a lot of imagery of open nature in the spiritual canticle. He runs through the mountains and the springs and all this kind of stuff. And that's a result of having been locked up in this cell, this dark cell in Toledo, by the other monks for a long period of time. And he finally escaped. And so for him, escaping from that dark cell was like going out into the sunlight. You know, so he uses a lot of those expressions in here that were kind of expressing what he felt when he finally got out of jail and was able to go walk around into the woods and everything. So he talks about the bridegroom giving the bride his breast. He said there he gives her his breast, and there teaches her a sweet living knowledge. He's not talking about milk. He's talking about knowledge. He's giving John something of himself, something of his substance. He's imparting that to John so that John can understand him better and love him more as a result. He's not talking about milk. Guys don't produce milk. So that's what he's kind of talking about there. This is in the preview, you know, leading up to it. I thought it would be important to kind of go through a little bit of that just to get a sense of what John's talking about when he goes through this poem. He actually composed this in his mind while he was in his prison cell in Toledo. And then he was able to write it down later when he got out. And he said what helped him were the images of the Song of Songs, something he knew by heart. The mountains, valleys, rivers, flowers, all that stuff. All the things we associate with being outside and free in the open country. Rearranging these images, he began composing his own song based on the Song of Songs. Then he went through three different versions of the spiritual canticle. The one we have here is his final version. The first version was only 31 stanzas. The final one was, I think, 40 stanzas. So, and then there was an order of nuns that he gave the canticle to, and they got very, very impressed with it, and they wanted him to explain more about it to them, and that's why he wrote the commentary. So he's got the spiritual canticle, the poem, and then after it, because the nuns asked him to do so, he wrote down his commentary, trying to explain to them what each of the stanzas in the spiritual canticle mean, and so that they could understand better what he was going through and trying to teach them about. When you get down to stanza 22, that's where you get into the idea of spiritual marriage. So from 22 to 40, you're in that deep union relationship with Christ. And when Teresa talks about that, she's talking about the seventh mansion, the place where only you and God can go, only you and Christ can go. She says not even the Blessed Mother can go there, because his relationship with you is so unique that when you get down to that level of spiritual growth, you only you and he are there, because his relationship to you is unique, because you're unique. He never changes, but you are unique. And so he does that. And so that's kind of what John is talking about during the last part of his spiritual canticle. He talks about the soul suffering during the betrothal period because of a more intense love. The soul is loving him more and more and wants that union. And so it feels kind of tortured almost because it can't get to that union quite yet. You can't get to the union yourself. God has to bring you there. And so the soul wants that. It said, bring me there, bring me there, bring me there. It's like going to heaven, you know, bring me there. But you can't do that till you die. You know? So you got to just wait till it's your turn.
So this is a lifetime.
Yeah, it's a lifetime. Yeah. It's a whole lifetime. Yep. Yep. So the spiritual canticle is really your spiritual life while you're on earth. And it talks about, you know, where you probably are at the beginning and where you could get to by the end of the poem. You know, but you got to work at it initially. And then once you work at it enough, you get to the point where God begins to do all the work in you. And for Teresa, that was the fourth mansion. For him, it's... you'll see it as we go through it. And he talks a little bit about the commentary before he gets into the thing. And so he introduces the canticle with a note to the Reverend Mother, who asked him to explain the canticle to them. He said, "It'd be foolish to think that expressions of love arising from the mystical understanding like these stanzas are fully explainable." And he makes a reference to St. Paul in Romans 8:26, where he says that when we can't figure out how to pray, the Holy Spirit comes and prays for us, in us, with unutterable, unspeakable groanings. That's the term that St. Paul uses. And so that's the kind of thing that's going on. There's this communication of love that is so deep, you don't know how to express it in words. You just know it's happening. And so that's what he's referring to here. And that's what St. Paul was referring to. That only the Holy Spirit can communicate the love to God in a way that's understandable by God. So John says, as a result, these persons let something of their experience overflow into figures, comparisons, similitudes, and from the abundance of their spirit pour out secrets and mysteries rather than rational explanations. And that's the way he gets to start talking to her about the fact that you can go through all this without ever having studied theology, without ever having studied, you know, things that a priest would normally study. So he had some of the training, but he said that a person can do all these things without ever having to go through that. Without ever going through that. So it's important to understand that too. So when you look at these stanzas and we go through those, you'll see things that in some cases you'll say, oh, I understand what this stanza is saying. I think I understand this. You read another one and you say, I have no clue what he's talking about here. And that's why the commentary is going to be so important for us to go through there. So when you get into the actual, get to the end of the prologue, get into the actual spiritual canticle itself, the first one that talks is the bride. And the bride is now at the point where they're actually seeking God. They love God enough, they're interested enough in God, that they're actually trying to find him. So the bride says, where have you hidden, beloved, and left me moaning? You fled like the stag after wounding me. I went out calling you, but you were gone. So here we have the soul seeking Christ. But the reason it's seeking Christ is because Christ has already touched it. It says, you fled like the stag after wounding me. So that wound is like Cupid's arrow, a wound of love. It helps you want to find Christ more deeply and more fully. And then he talks to people you might encounter along the way. He says, shepherds, you who go up through the sheepfolds to the hill, if by chance you see him I love most, tell him I am sick, I suffer, and I die. So he's looking around at things in nature. And people in nature, shepherds, flocks. He says, if you see the one I'm seeking, tell him I'm seeking him, and he better let me find him, because I'm going to die if I don't find him. It's that level of desire, you know, that you really want to be united to Christ very, very much. He says, seeking my love, I will head for the mountains and for the water slides. I will not gather flowers, nor will I fear wild beasts. I will go beyond strong men and frontiers. He's beginning to tell you that he's not interested in any of these things that he finds. You can find God in creation. St. Paul tells us that in his letter to the Romans. He said you can prove to yourself that God exists by just looking at creation. And so you can find out some things about God in creation. But he's saying, okay, I've done that. I'm not interested anymore. He says, I will not gather the flowers. I will not do this. The only thing I want is Christ. That's the only thing that's going to satisfy me. No flowers, no trees, no mountains, no waterfalls, no strong men, no frontiers to conquer or anything. All I want is Christ. And he goes on, oh, woods and thickets, planted by the hand of my beloved. O green meadow, coated bright with flowers, tell me, has he passed by you? So he's seeing God's creation. He sees God's hand in creation, but he doesn't want that creation. All he wants to know is, has he passed by here? Have you seen him? Can you tell me where to go to find him? And what does he do while he's running away from the bride? Pours out 1,000 graces. Pour pouring out 1,000 graces, he passed these groves in haste, and having looked at them with his image alone, clothed them in beauty. He's got several references to beauty in relationship to God here. The idea of the beauty of God was a realization he came to in his meditations. And it made a big impression on him. And so he makes references to that throughout here. Like he's got it here. He's also got it in verse 11. He says, may the vision of your beauty be my death, etc. In other words, if I look upon your beauty, it's going to be so great that I cannot continue to exist as a person. I'm going to have to die and then be united to you in heaven because you're so beautiful. And that idea of God and beauty is a big part of the spirituality of the Orthodox Church. It's a big part of the spirituality of the Orthodox Church deals with the beauty of God. And so they have books they write on the beauty of God. They have that's behind this whole icon. When they write an icon, they don't paint an icon. I told you that before, right? They write an icon because it tells a story. Okay. So when they write these icons, that idea of the beauty of God and the beauty of his saints is what you see, what they see in these icons. So before anybody can write an icon, they have to get permission from their religious superiors. A person can't just decide, oh, I'm going to write an icon today, you know. They have to get permission to do that. And so that idea of the beauty of God is all through here. And because he has that beauty, he can then impart that beauty to his creation. It won't be a perfect image of his, but you'll be able to see some of his beauty in the beauty of his creation. And so he's wounded now. He's suffering, and he says, ah, who has the power to heal me? Now, wholly surrender yourself. He's telling Christ to surrender himself because he's wounded, and he needs somebody to heal him, and only Christ has the power to heal him. He said, don't send me any more messengers. Don't send me any more prophets. Don't send me any more bishops and priests and everything else. Just send me yourself. That's the only thing that's going to cure me. Don't send me any more messengers. They cannot tell me what I must hear because they don't know God well enough. They don't know Christ well enough to communicate him to John the way Christ can communicate himself to John. Okay. All who are free, tell me 1,000 graceful things of you. All wound me more and leave me dying of, I don't know what, behind their stammering. So all those who have free, they're telling John thousands of things about God. And all of them wound him even more because all they do is make him want God that much more.
When he says all who are free, who is he referring to?
Well, that's what we'll look at in the commentary. We'll look at the commentary on stanza 7 and see what he's talking about there. Okay. Those are one who... probably the ones who are free of things of this world. Okay? That'd be my guess. So they wound me the more because of what they're saying, because he wants Christ so much. And they leave me dying of, I don't know what, behind their stammering. To him, when they're trying to communicate God to him, when they're trying to explain God to him, it's like stammering. Because nobody can do it so completely and fully. Okay? He says, how do you endure, O life, not living where you live, and being brought near death by the arrows you receive from that which you conceive of your beloved? So again, he's talking about like a little Cupid with the arrows of love, that God keeps sending these arrows of love to him, and says bringing him near death because of that love. From that which you conceive of your beloved. So the more God starts to communicate himself to him, the more deeply he's feeling it. And so he's going through this, in his early stanzas here, he's going through that purgative stage of spiritual development. He's shedding the things of this world from him. Even nature. He says, I don't even need that. You know, I don't have any attachment. You know, if you look at the Enchiridion, when it talks about getting a plenary indulgence, it says one of the conditions of plenary indulgence is no attachment to sin. Doesn't mean you don't commit sin. It means you don't have an attachment to a particular sin to the point where you refuse to give that sin up. You might still commit that sin just because of your weakness, but you have to... It says you can't have an attachment to it that's so strong that you refuse to give it up. And so you have to be able to do that to get a plenary indulgence. And so unless you're so locked into a particular sin, you don't have to really worry too much about that. But there are some people that just have a certain kind of sin, they just won't give up. It's almost like an addiction, like gambling. You know, they got a dollar, they're going to go put it into a slot machine or something, you know, rather than put it in a pool box at church. That would kill them, yeah, because they're not getting a chance to get more out of it, you know. So those kind of things. And then he starts questioning the bridegroom, but you know, why, since you wounded his heart, don't you heal it? All you're doing is wounding me. Why don't you come fix me? Why don't you come heal me? You know. And so now he's complaining. And why, since you stole it from me, do you leave it so and fail to carry off what you have stolen? Whereas you have stolen my heart, why don't you come get it? Why don't you? I'm willing to give it to you, the whole thing. Why don't you come get it and take it off, to, you know, carry it off? He says, extinguish these miseries, since no one else can stamp them out. May my eyes behold you, because you are their light, and I would open them to you alone. Only you can stamp out these miseries, these things I want. Your love is what I want. I want you. I want to be united to you. And please let my eyes behold you, because that's the only thing my eyes want to see. They don't want to see anything else. The only light they want to see is you. And I would open them, I would open my eyes to you alone. So I'm not going to be impressed with any other things, any other material things, anything like that. So you're gradually getting to the point where you're detaching yourself from these things of the world, and you're getting to the point where you begin to see God as he is, the essence of God. You're beginning to see God and recognize that he is the one you really want. You want to belong to. So he says, reveal your presence, and may the vision of your beauty be my death. For the sickness of love is not cured except by your very presence and image. He's finally getting it. He's finally understanding that. He says, reveal your presence to me. Now, God will do that. Even if he's not going to appear to you like he's done to some of the saints, he's still going to reveal his presence to you. And you sense that. You feel him working inside of you. And so you begin to get that sense that, yeah, he does love you. He does want you. He wants to teach you more about himself. And so you get to that point where now John's saying, reveal your presence, and may the vision of your beauty be my death. He's looking for God to come down and appear to him. You know, because he figures that's the only thing that's going to satisfy him. For the sickness of love is not cured except by your very presence and image. So he thinks that in order to be fully cured, he's got to physically see God. That Christ has to come down and appear to him. But that's doesn't have to happen. God can communicate himself completely to you without ever standing in front of you and letting you see his image. Because he can communicate that to the depths of your soul. With Teresa, it was getting to the seventh mansion, the seventh depth of your soul. In her mind, there were seven levels within your soul. And the deepest level was where you and you, only you and God can go.
Oh, spring like crystal, if only on your silvered over faces you would suddenly form the eyes that I have desired, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. And so again, he's saying, I want to see you. I want to see your face. I want to see your eyes. And then he says, withdraw then, beloved. I am taking flight. He's running. He can't stand it anymore, so he's going to run away because God won't save him and heal his wounds. And the minute he tries to take flight, what does the bridegroom do? The bridegroom comes, return, dove. The wounded stag is in sight on the hill, cooled by the breeze of your flight. Now the bridegroom is saying that the stag, who is him, is wounded. What's he wounded by? What is his wound? Now, this is Christ we're talking about here. The bridegroom, okay? But he says, I'm wounded. What is he wounded by?
By his flight. He's fleeing. John's fleeing from God.
Why does that wound God?
Because he loves him.
Yeah. He's already wounded by John's love. Remember, when they talk about wounding, they're not talking about hurting. They're talking about receiving something of love that affects you so much, it's like being wounded. Okay? You're not being injured. You're given a spark of God's love that feels like it's wounding you, you know, because it affects you so much. And when you feel that, you can't live without it. You know? It's kind of like a young man or a woman, you know, they guy sees her and man, he's that's all he cares about, you know. He wants to see this creature. If he can't find her, he goes crazy, you know, and runs all around. And you know, it's just young it's like that with God. You know, the wounding is the wound of love, and with God he imparts himself to you, and that creates the wound, and your response to that, your loving response to that, is the wound that he receives. Now, John refers to it as a wound because of its effect, but it's actually love. And we'll see more about that when we look at the commentaries. So then the bride responds after he says, return. He says, my beloved, the mountains with and lonely wooded valleys, strange islands and resounding rivers, the whistling of love-stirring breezes, the tranquil night at the time of the rising dawn, silent music, sounding solitude, the supper that refreshes and deepens love. So he goes on and talks about the things that he runs into. The supper that refreshes and deepens love. What do you think he's talking about there? Probably the Eucharist. We'll take a look at that when we look at the commentaries on that, on stanza 15. But we'll see what he's talking about that. Then Bryce says, catch us the foxes, for our vineyard is now in flower, while we fashion a cone of roses intricate as the pines, and let no one appear on the hill. So he's beginning to talk about the things that he's going to start doing. He's been chasing. And now he's going to start doing some other things that are going to help him illuminate, help God illuminate inside his soul. I don't understand the part where he says, catch us the foxes, for our vineyard is now in flower. I'm not sure what foxes have to do with grapes, but when we get to the commentary, we'll see what he's talking about there. So be still, deadening north wind, south wind, come, you that waken love. Breathe through my garden, let his fragrance flow, and the beloved will feed amid the flowers. So now he's talking about this garden that he's got and the fragrances, and that the beloved is going to feed among the flowers. So he's bringing the beloved back to him. The blood is not running away anymore. He's coming back. Because the first thing it says, read your return, the wounded stag is in sight on the hill, cooled by the breeze of your flight. And so now they're starting to come together. It's not a chase anymore. They're kind of walking toward each other. And then he gets a little bit mystical. Talks about you girls of Judea, while among flowers and roses. He's going back to the Song of Songs when he says that. He's going back to Solomon's Song of Songs, talking about the girls of Judea. You girls of Judea, while among flowers and roses, the amber spreads its perfume. Stay away there on the outskirts. Do not so much as seek to touch our thresholds. So what's he saying there? This is one competition. You girls of Judea, stay away there on the outskirts. Don't so much as seek to touch our thresholds. Hide yourself, my love. Now he's talking to the bridegroom. Hide yourself, my love. Turn your face toward the mountains and do not speak. But look at those companions going with her through strange islands. So we'll take a look at that. As we get into the commentary, we're going to see a lot more about what he's really talking about here in these different stanzas. And let's break it off here, and we'll pick up with 20 next time. And if you want, good, so read ahead a little bit and maybe look at some of the commentaries and see if anything really strikes a fancy to you. Because right after the end of the poem, he gets into the commentaries. And each stanza is a commentary for each one of the stanzas. So you can see exactly what he's talking about, how he explains it when you look at the stanzas. Okay, we'll finish that up. Okay. After we do the spiritual canticle, we can go into the living flame of love, which is like a continuation. And of course, the living flame of love is Christ. And so we can get into that. And then I would do the ascent of Mount Carmel and then the dark night of the soul. Do those. And Mary Beth and I have been talking, and I think once we finish with John of the Cross and go through all of his stuff, we're going to kind of retire.
What?
We've been doing this for 24 years. So,
but only here for a while.
Yeah. But our grandkids are getting to be of an age where we'd like to spend more time with them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's really hard now because they're up in Maryland. And if we want to go spend a weekend with them, we got to leave really early Saturday morning and then get up at the crack of dawn on Sunday to get back here for mass and sessions and stuff. And we'd like to spend more time with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's, so after we finish John, we're going to kind of retire. But if you guys come across something that you'd like to get together with on from time to time and have a discussion of, you know, just let me know. We could certainly do that. Doesn't mean I'm going away forever. You know, I mean, I'm not going to disappear. So, you know, from time to time, if there's something that comes up that you want to discuss or something, just let me know, and we'll be happy to do that. Because, I think we've gone through a lot of very helpful stuff. You know, and I think John is going to be particularly insightful. A lot of people really get a lot out of looking at his stuff. So, any thoughts on what we've done so far today?
This, the Song of Solomon.
Yeah.
Solomon got away from God in the end.
Right.
You know?
He did. Yep. He had all these pagan wives, and he was influenced by them. He got into idolatry.
Yeah.
So he fell away.
But for him to write that, he also was seeking God.
Well, he did. When he was younger.
Yeah.
You know, the one gift that he asked of God was wisdom, right? And so God said, I will give you wisdom, but I will give you much more besides. And so Solomon saw his, one of his tasks was to unite kingdoms around Israel. And he would do that by intermarriage with the daughters of those other kings. Now, so he ended up with like 300 wives and 700 concubines, and you know how he could even keep the name straight, I'll never know. You know, I have a harder time with just one, much less a thousand. You know, so in the end, he was overly influenced by these. So even somebody who was the wisest man ever, and gave such great gifts, he still didn't take care of those gifts. He didn't treasure him enough to treasure him. He saw his duties as king superseding some of that. And so he tried to unite all these kingdoms to make one big, you know, big kingdom and all. Of course, after he died, his son was a terrible king. And he started taxing the heck out of everybody, and everybody kind of fell apart. And so the whole kingdom fell apart. But, you know, the Queen of Sheba came just to, because she heard about his wisdom. You know, so when he was young, he was really good. Did a lot of good things. And his mother was the advocate of the people. Bathsheba sat on his right side. And she would take the petitions of the people, intercede for them before Solomon. Just like the Blessed Mother does before her son. That's why they say Bathsheba is an image of Mary. Even though her moral life wasn't the same, her role as intercessor with the king, you know, was that thing. So, and that's one of the cautions that you have, that when you start going through this and you grow spiritually, and you begin to, you know, understand that you've made some progress, don't let it get to your head. Don't let it do like Solomon did, you know, and fall away. Because no matter how far you progress spiritually, you can always progress a little more. As always, because you're never going to be equal to God, right? And spiritual progression is union with getting to be union with God and getting to be more like God, and letting Him divinize your soul, like Peter, you know, Saint Peter tells us in his letter, that when you unite yourself to Christ, He's going to divinize your soul. Well, you can lose that by pride. You can lose that, by not treasuring it and keeping it. And so those are the things that you have to really watch out for.
Yeah, look, this doesn't have anything to do with our reading, but it has upset me so much, the McCarrick thing.
Yeah.
The gifts that he had.
Yeah.
And, I mean, how could he even pray when he was doing these things?
That's a mystery. You know, the human failings are something that happens. And if you don't really watch out, it can overtake you. St. Paul says in one of his letters, I do not what I want to do, but what I don't want to do.
Right, but he was right next to God in the church.
It's a terrible thing.
It just really, and all I could think of was the vocation directors who had sent boys to those seminaries, if not knowing what.
Right.
It's a
terrible thing. It really is. You know, there's an old saying that the road to hell is paved with the skulls of priests and bishops. So, you know, this is not something you like to think about, but people have fallibilities. Pride gets to them. You know, Pope Paul VI said that the smoke of Satan is in the Vatican, right? I mean, Satan can exercise his influence in a lot of different places, and so you have to watch out for it. And that's why we're so blessed when we get popes like John Paul II and Pope Benedict and all, who are such tremendous role models.
Oh yes.
And watch out for the church so carefully.
And the pain of the good priests who see this.
Yeah,
and
great.
Think that's how they're being judged.
Yeah. My son talked about that quite a bit. You know, when that whole scandal broke out, he said, I feel so bad because of what my brother priests have done. And I know people look at me and wonder if I'm that way, you know. He said it really hurts. And he said, nothing I can do about it except pray. Yeah. And just pray that this whole thing goes away.
And Christ said to Peter, Satan has demanded that he sift you like wheat.
Right. Yeah. And so it just shows how vigilant you have to be. And how quickly pride can overtake people. You know, a man becomes a priest and he's enthusiastic to serve. Then he becomes a bishop. And sometimes it goes to their head. They begin to look at their own self-importance, you know. The minute that starts to happen, Satan's going to walk right in and grab you. And that's why John Paul II was such a tremendous example, because, you know, given his progress through the church, he still remained humble.
Yes, he did.
You know, he was still a humble man. And that's the one thing that can keep Satan from killing you, by staying humble. Pride is the one thing that can just bring anybody to a downfall.
Pride goes before the fall.
Exactly. That's a good saying. You know, and so people like McCarrick and others that fall, you know, can usually it's rooted in pride of some kind. And it can happen to any of us. You don't have to be a priest or a bishop for that to happen. Any of us can do that, you know. And it can happen to any of us.
Well, as long as you have children pointing out your faults, I think
you're... Yeah, that's true. You can do that. But, And so you have to be always on your guard. Because Satan's always looking for any excuse to find a crack in the door to kind of put his nose through the tent. And you just have to be conscious. You know, and that's why St. Ignatius always recommended that you do an examination of conscience every night. You know, every night when you go to bed. Yes, how did I do today? You know, did I do anything that really offended you? If I did, help me understand what it was and help me not to do it again. You don't have to sit there and flog yourself and commiserate what a miserable person you are. But it's a question of, you know, do I recognize my fault? And then can I do something? Can I do something to overcome it, to not do it tomorrow? You can't say I'll never do it again for the rest of my life. But you say, can you help me not do this tomorrow? Just take it a day at a time, you know, one day at a time. That's all you can do.
I see another thing. People who you become more mystical and more God-loving, but then somewhere along the line, I wonder about boredom. I mean, maybe that's another way of saying pride. You get bored and doing the same thing.
I think the pride is the right answer there. Because if you get to that point like John got to, the excitement of union with God is never going to get boring. Because he's always communicating himself to you. You're always learning more about him. And the more you learn about him, the more you love. And the more you love, the more you want to learn. And it's kind of like a never-ending process. And so it's never going to... The minute you find yourself bored with God, that's when you say, okay, I got to look at my prayer life. I got to look at my prayer life and I got to see what that's like. And
is that dryness? Is that a spiritual dryness?
Spiritual dryness is different from boredom. Mm-hmm. Spiritual dryness is when you recognize that God deserves your prayer. You have an obligation to pray just because of who God is. God is who he is. But you don't get that sweetness from praying. You don't get that sense of, you know, fondness that you might ordinarily have had. And so God is telling you in that he wants you to love him for himself. Not because of what he gives you. The old saying is you learn to love the God of consolations, not the consolations of God. So even if he withdraws all of his consolation,
Even when you pray and you don't feel anything, you still pray. Because God is there. And when we get into the dark night of the soul, you'll see that. A big lesson from the dark night of the soul is that when God withdraws from you like that, and you feel like he's abandoning you, that's when he's closer to you than ever. And because it is a way of giving you a test, in a sense, but also teaching you that he's never going to abandon you. He's always going to be there. He's never, ever, ever going to abandon you. You never have to worry about that. And that's part of what that lesson is in the dark night. No matter how dark it seems, he's closer to you then than at any other time. You can reach out and touch him.
When you have to make yourself pray. Is it,
And the reason you make yourself pray is because you've progressed enough to know that God deserves your prayer, regardless of anything else. You don't pray to God because he gives you stuff. You pray to God because he's God. And he deserves your prayer. You owe him prayer. And when you realize that, you pray and he might pull back. You might pray and not feel anything from it. But that's okay.
That's what Mother Teresa went through for 35 years.
Mother Teresa went through for many years, yeah. And Teresa of Avila went through a long period. And she found that if she got to the point where she just couldn't pray, she would do spiritual reading. That's why I built this 3,000 book library. Because if I get there, I've always got a book to read. It might take me the rest of my life to go through, but I've got a book to read. You know? she used spiritual reading as a substitute for that. Because that's another form of praying. Spiritual reading is another form of praying. Maybe praying is communication with God. And if you can communicate through God through the teachings of someone else, you know, it's okay. It doesn't have to be all you. So, you can do that. But it is sad when you see those kind of things happen within the church. But you got to know, the one thing that keeps me going with the church is that Jesus said, I will be with you until the end of time. And I will not leave you orphans. You know, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So, you know, take those three things and you just put all your hope in him. You just, okay, okay God, I'm going to latch on to you because I know one way or the other you're gonna take care of it.
And all the bad popes that we've had, all the scandals, all the Catholic Church is still with us.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Think of all the people that have tried to destroy the church from within and from without. And it's still there.
Almost a virulent end. And why is that? It's
because Satan's trying to do it. Satan sees himself as the prince of this world, as the king of this world. When he tempted Christ, he said, all this belongs to me. I will give it to you if you worship me. You know? And so he sees this whole domain as this. And
when is he going to be chained up again? I thought
that. I hope soon.
I hope soon.
Because Christ has got to come back and get his kingdom. The thing that also keeps me going is knowing that as the church, we are the mystical body of Christ. And if you never lose sight of that, if you never lose sight of the fact that you are part of the mystical body of Christ, that can get you through a lot. That can get you through a lot. I know Mary Beth mentioned it several times, how much it means to her to be part of the mystical body of Christ, you know. And that's true. I mean, it's if you really realize that, that helps you get through a lot.
But you know, we have the guarantee that Christ said the gates of hell won't prevail.
Yeah.
We're part of the mystical body, and things, you know, I consider all of that attacks of Satan.
Yeah.
Using these poor, you know, McCarrick and somebody else, it's like, you know, all of them are, you know, falling prey to Satan.
Right.
In their, you know, his tactics and everything else.
That's right.
I mean, this has been going on for many years. I mean, at least 20 years has been going on with McCarrick.
Yeah.
Yes, but and none of us knew.
Huh?
And no, only people knew, but it,
it was,
they didn't do anything. Right. That was fine.
Because they were afraid of what it
would
look like if it got in the papers.
Well, not just that, but, you know, they were afraid to bring it up against an archbishop.
Well, that too, you know, that's, I understood it was 47 years ago when he was not a bishop yet. He was still in New York as a priest.
Yeah. To me, the what he did to the seminarians was the worst, the very worst. That, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, they were young boys wanting to become priests.
Yep.